Welcome to the History of Chemistry podcast. I'm Steve Cohen, your host, and this is episode 93, Resistance is Futile, on the discovery of high-temperature superconductors. Thanks to those who already support this podcast. Support the continuation of this podcast at Patreon. The website is www.patreon.com/thehistoryofchemistry. One of the great and chance discoveries in the 1980s was something that hovers on the border between physics and chemistry, that is, superconductivity at high temperatures. Usually physics seems to claim this discovery for itself, but we shall explore the chemical aspects of this phenomenon. As with many chemical discoveries, we can trace their ultimate roots back to the 19th century. In this case, we go all the way back to Humphrey Davy, who was the powerhouse for discovering elements in the first decades of the 19th century. At the time, Dalton's new atomic theory was all the rage in chemistry, and at that time there were around 40 elements known, of which 26 were metals. All of these metals had similar properties that we all learn about in basic science classes. They are ductile, that is, they can be drawn out into wires. They conduct electricity well. They are shiny or, as we can say, metallic-looking. And they conduct heat well. Other elements didn't have these properties. Based on some deductions, Davy concluded that metals had some internal common principle, and that atoms couldn't be the smallest particles of everything. There had to be something even smaller. Unfortunately, it took another 85 years until J.J. Thomson discovered electrons to show that Davy was right. Davy also argued by chemical analogy that certain gaseous elements, namely hydrogen and nitrogen, would also be metallic if they could be solidified. But on a practical matter, this was impossible at the beginning of the 19th century, until his assistant, Michael Faraday, came along. Faraday had a knack for doing unusual experiments with wild and crazy results. Faraday, in early 1823, was able to liquefy chlorine gas. He did this by putting a dried chlorine compound into a sealed glass tube, immersed the tube into water at 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which generated a yellow fluid and gas. The gas condensed into more yellow fluid when the tube was cooled to 32 degrees Fahrenheit. Further study of the substance in the tube showed it to be liquid chlorine, formed under pressure. So, Faraday showed that at least one gaseous element could be liquefied. Why not the others? Could he not show that nitrogen and hydrogen solids were metals? Faraday thus tried to condense every gas he could find, doing sometimes extremely dangerous experiments with occasionally extremely dangerous consequences. The glass tubes for his experiments once in a while exploded in his face. The idea of laboratory safety was not a thing yet. But he did manage to liquefy almost every gas, except for nitrogen, oxygen, and hydrogen, so he was unable to prove Davy's idea. It still took many decades to liquefy these last three gases. Frenchman Louis-Paul Cailleté and Swiss Raoul-Pierre Pictet almost simultaneously were able to make mists of liquid oxygen, so their claim to liquid oxygen fame is debatable, but not until 1877. Karol Olszewski with Zygmunt Wroblewski definitely got liquid oxygen and nitrogen in Poland in 1883. That left hydrogen and the yet-to-be-discovered noble gases, and it seems that doing hydrogen turned into a kind of technological race between two physicists, Kamerlingh Onnes of Holland and James Dewar of Britain. Based on gas theories, the predicted condensation temperature for hydrogen was at only 33 kelvins, or minus 240 degrees Celsius. Technically, this was really, really difficult. The method was to cool a gas in multiple rounds of compression, cooled with refrigerants, evaporated to cool it again, and repeat many times. Onnes had bad press. The Leiden City Council found out that he was storing compressed hydrogen gas under the university lecture hall with no safety precautions. Remember that safety wasn't a big thing yet? And so they shut him down. While that happened, Peter Zeeman found that spectral peaks in magnetic fields split, a big thing in spectroscopy and found in Leiden. But in revenge, Onnes stopped the town of Leiden from getting any credit for it. Onnes did improve safety, and finally the council let him restart his attempts to liquefy hydrogen, but it was too late. In the meantime, in 1896, Dewar won the race to liquefy hydrogen. His invention of what we might call a Dewar flask or thermos bottle helped him along the way. Such a bottle is double-walled, with a vacuum between the inner and outer walls to prevent significant heat transfer. That meant all known gases were condensed. Except they now weren't all the known gases. The previous year, in 1895, William Ramsay discovered helium gas on Earth, and so the race was on to condense the new helium into solid at 4 kelvins, or minus 269 degrees Celsius. Onnes took on the challenge. It took him 13 years, even while annoyed that Dewar used his Dewar flask, so Onnes refused to try out a Dewar flask along the way. Onnes succeeded in July 1908 at getting liquefied helium, and for 15 years after this, Leiden University was the sole place where you could get liquid helium. The challenge for Onnes then remained. Can we solidify helium? 2 years after liquefying helium, the research group got to a temperature of 1 Kelvin, minus 272 degrees Celsius, but guess what? No solid helium. Onnes finally gave up and left the experiments to others. In fact, solid helium was first obtained in 1926 by Willem Kaesum in Onnes's lab, but only after both squeezing and cryogenically cooling the liquid. But there were now new questions about matter to solve at low temperatures, and Onnes's group was singularly placed to examine them. The question now was, how did metals conduct electricity at the lowest temperatures? The electron was only discovered 13 years earlier, so scientists were trying to place electrical conductivity into a theory including these new electrons. In 1900s, Germans Eduard Riecke and Paul Drude came up with physical models of electricity as a fluid, or gas, which is a fluid because it flows. If you apply an electric field to an object, the electron gas will drift, and we see that as an electric current. Note here again a gas, but of electrons. But James Dewar, of course, also got interested in cryogenic things, put metals into his ultra-cold liquids, and measured electrical resistance. As the metal got colder, the electrical resistance didn't drop linearly. Instead, it came down to a constant value. There were two popular hypotheses at the time to explain this. Mathiasen's rule, invented by Augustus Mathiasen in Britain. Residual resistance to electron flow depended on other impurities found in the metal's crystal structure. Fewer impurities should give lower resistance. Or, another idea was that electrons condense out of their electron gas back onto individual atoms in the metal. This model suggested that there would be a lowest resistance, But as condensation starts, electrical resistance rises at the very lowest temperatures. So the new fad became not condensing gases, but condensing this alleged electron gas. In the meantime also, Albert Einstein came up with an idea in 1906 using the also new quantum theory to model why different solids absorbed different amounts of heat to raise their temperature by 1 degree. He described solids using quantum oscillators. If we guess that such oscillations blocked electrical flow, then as the temperature dropped, these oscillations reduced, and electrical resistance also fell, but to zero as we get to absolute zero temperature.
We'll be right back.
Hi, and welcome to Hiss and Tell, a cat podcast where we delve deep into the fascinating world of feline behavior with your host, me, Christina Wilson, a professional animal behaviorist. Each episode features insightful discussions with leading veterinarians, dedicated researchers and scientists, experts in cat behavior and training, and so much more. Join me as we decode the complexities of pet loss, unravel the mysteries of feline health and behavior, and discover the latest research findings. I'll meet you at Hiss and Tell.
Onnes decided to jump on the Einstein bandwagon and test this idea of quantum oscillators using a common element, mercury. Mercury could be distilled and purified easily, and might have a large enough resistance at the liquefying temperature of helium, 4 kelvins, to measure. Onnes had his student, Gilles Holst, with the technician G.N. Flim, who ran the helium liquefying apparatus to do the experiment. They cooled mercury down to 4 kelvins and saw the resistance vanish to less than 1/10,000,000th of its value by 3 kelvins, which they thought was a short circuit in the equipment. Except that every time the temperature rose above 4 kelvins, the short circuit fixed itself, and every time it fell below that, the short circuit appeared. Holst realized that the sudden drop in resistance below 4 kelvins didn't follow Einstein's model of quantum oscillators. This is the point in which most histories of superconductivity start, but I want to bring you the context and background of Onnes' research. Holst's professor, Onnes, brought the observations to Brussels for a conference at the end of October 1911. It gradually became a sensation within a couple of years, and Onnes got a Nobel Prize for his work on cryogenic helium. He also found that the same superconducting state, that is, conducting electricity with no measurable resistance, occurred in tin and lead, but not in platinum or gold. We have thus reached the point to describe a superconductor, that is, a material that conducts electricity with no usual resistance. There was, however, no good theory to explain this. The next advance in superconductivity research was in 1933. The famous Max von Laue proposed an experiment to Walter Meissner to see if the superflow of electrons happened in the material throughout or just on the material's surface. Meissner and Robert Oxenfeld built an apparatus with a tiny coil of wire to measure the magnetic field between two cold tin cylinders, through which ran electrical current simultaneously. They found that the magnetic field between the cylinders increased even when no current was running, as the tin bits were chilled. Superconductors were perfect electrical conductors, and they expel magnetic fields from inside their materials. This became called the Meissner effect. And yet, still, there was no good explanation. In 1951, after the success of the transistor, John Bardeen began thinking about superconductivity. After several years of struggling, he was able to get Leon Cooper, a postdoctoral researcher at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey, along with a graduate student of Bardeen named J. Robert Schrieffer. They felt competition from Richard Feynman and worked hard to solve the problem. They did by April 1957, in which their model pairs up electrons to act like single particles together. There was also a gap in energy levels between the most stable state and higher level electron states, leaving the electrons in the lowest levels at super cold temperatures. It models the Meissner effect, expelling magnetic fields from superconductors. It models why different materials have different specific heats. The Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer theory of conductivity seemed to work quite well. And in general, the scientific opinion was that superconductivity could only occur at such supercold temperatures, near the boiling point of liquid helium. The best or highest transition from superconductivity seen for about 7 decades after Onnes's research was niobium germanium, NB3GE, with a transition temperature around 23 kelvins, only a few degrees above liquid hydrogen's boiling point. A side note, why do we care about transition temperatures? If we can harness compounds that superconduct, all the electrical loss from transmitting electrical power across national grids goes away. All electrical circuits waste power from resistance, resulting in hot electronics. Everything from high-voltage power transmission cables to public lighting to electric transit systems waste power from resistance. So, if we can find some material that can transmit electricity with no loss at a reasonable temperature, not some outer space temperature, we can save substantial amounts of energy. Cooling to liquid helium temperature is just not practical, though. In the early 1980s, Swiss Carl Alexander Müller was an employee at IBM Zurich Research Laboratory in Switzerland, interested in seeing if he could find other compounds with even higher transition temperatures. He got German Georg Bednortz to join the IBM facility, the same place where the work on the scanning tunneling microscope happened. Müller's idea was that maybe some oxides would work, but most people in the field dismissed him. But Müller was right. He and Bednortz found in 1986 that lanthanum barium copper oxide, a brittle black ceramic substance, would superconduct as high as 35 kelvins, an increase of 12 degrees over the previous material. This was not a jump of a fraction of a degree, but an amazing amount. They published their observations in the journal Zeitschrift für Physik B in June 1986 under the title Possible High TC Superconductivity in the BALACUO System. Two different researchers around the world confirmed their results soon after. Japanese Shoji Tanaka in Tokyo, Japan, and Chinese-American Paul Chu at the University of Houston in Texas. That jump-started the small number of researchers still active in superconductivity. If 35 kelvins was possible, what higher temperature was doable? Paul Chu was obviously one of those involved, and by the last day of December 1986, he announced that he could do even better by 5 kelvins, and the famous Bell Laboratories also announced a 6 kelvin higher superconductor temperature. Things were heating up, if you pardon the pun. Chu in Houston came up with a wild idea. Suppose you squeeze the material at cryogenic temperatures. Would that work for superconductivity? If you squeeze things, the atoms shift around a bit, and maybe that could improve the transition temperature. It worked. He was able to squeeze at 10,000 atmospheres and raise the temperature a bit higher. Then he considered raising the internal pressure by using denser atoms in the oxide structure. For example, he put strontium inside instead of barium, and yttrium instead of lanthanum, crushing the materials into powder and baking these oxides in a small furnace at all sorts of temperatures. There were a lot of variables to test for. By January, he had an odd compound with a greenish color. Yttrium barium copper oxide, unlike the typical black oxides that were semiconductors. That one also superconducted, but at the unheard-of temperature of 93 kelvins, way higher than anything else imaginable, with no external pressure needed. What was remarkable about this greenish ceramic was that it only needed liquid nitrogen to cool it, which is far more practical than liquid helium. Chu and his team announced the results in February 1987, and the result was mayhem in the science world. The annual conference of the American Physical Society was held in New York in March, and the organizers hastily added a session on superconducting materials, which became called the Woodstock of Physics. It was madness, like the cold fusion of the American Chemical Society 2 years later. The material itself was given the formula Y1.2Ba0.8Cu0.4, but later research showed it was really a mixture of two different phases, a typical black one plus the green one. The actual superconductor was the black one, with the composition YBa2Cu3O7-delta. The delta means it's less than 7 by a variable amount. To make this original compound, Chu sintered various metal carbonates, barium carbonate, yttrium carbonate, and copper carbonate, all in oxygen. The structure of this compound is layered. There are planar CuO4 units sharing oxygen atoms with CuO2 ribbons. Between the planes containing CuO4, there are yttrium atoms, and between the CuO2 units and the CuO4 units are the barium atoms. It turns out that this compound, though it superconducts as currently made, it is not a single crystal, but of many crystals. This results in a lower amount of current that can go through the material, blocked by boundaries between the crystals. The other major problem is that this material is not ductile. That is, unlike metals, it cannot be drawn into convenient wires. It's a brittle ceramic. Superconductors so far have had limited use in modern technology, even as the number of high-temperature superconductors continues to rise, as well as their superconducting temperature. Some of the lower-temperature superconductors are used in strong magnets for medical imaging and particle accelerators. The fabulous predictions of lossless electrical transmission have yet to appear in real life. In addition, there is currently no good theory to explain these high-temperature superconductors. But research continues, and we await new developments in these unusual chemicals. In our next episode, we talk of wine chemistry and the twin wine scandals that rocked Europe in the mid-1980s. Until then, brave the elements! Thank you for listening to the History of Chemistry podcast.